Okay, that is last session in our astrobiology course, and this is really honored to have Dr. Watt with us today. Unfortunately, as you can see, we have the cameras here because he is planning to retire, and I just want to make sure that the coming class has his lecture, and he's with us in the last 10-12 years that we start this course, and I think one of the most important part of this course is actually, as I said, to actually bring this contrast between engineers. They tell us how easy it is to go to space, but what we'll show you now through his experience that he was working with all the astronauts. And he was the director, or he's still director of the aerospace medicine here at McGill, the Department of Physiology. And as I said, he's most experienced with all the astronauts and any space travel. And please enjoy and interact with him. I think we had in the past a lot of interaction. I don't know how is it going to work with the camera, but feel free to ask questions if there's anything. And interact, that's what we like. And hopefully we will enjoy. When you march through the second mission, it's going to be just outside when you leave the road. And we will discuss at some stage.
All right.
Okay.
Well, thank you. First of all, let me get this volume up a little bit here. And hopefully. Okay, I want to clarify a couple of things before I start here. One, just in case you heard, this is the last session. This is the last topic. There are three lectures that are going to be given on this material. The other thing is more a long-term thing, where over the years I've sort of gotten a reputation as being a kind of a Dr. No, where people sometimes think I've got a very negative view on space flight and especially manned space flight. And that's not really the case. What I'm really trying to show you in this set of lectures is that from a human factors point of view, there are still a lot of challenges that have to be met before we start, going gallivanting around in space. I guess Professor Valley sort of touched on one of the issues, and that is that engineers kind of think that just because you can make the machine, that you can just stuff a person into it and all will be well. The trouble is that's not quite the case. And what I'm going to do in the next three lectures is a kind of a reality check on what we can and what we can't do in the way of human spaceflight. And basically, as it stands today, now one hopes that this is going to change. The fact is, though, that despite 50 years of experience, and it is 50 years this year, we can still just barely put somebody into space and bring them back alive. In fact, we don't have an extraordinarily good track record. If you were one of the 500 or so people that were astronauts, you would have had a 4% chance of dying on the job. It's a 4% mortality rate just by being an astronaut. There have been a number of flight accidents. I'm not even talking about ground accidents, of which there have been quite a few also. But in flight accidents, we've actually killed 18 people out of about 500, which I think says a lot about how, well, both the engineering is not perfect, but also the human beings are far from perfect. Of course, at this point, it's also easy to get a little bit negative, perhaps even more than usual, because we've got a number of serious problems when it comes to actually doing flight. These are temporary things, but they certainly do exist today, and not the least of which is that the space shuttle is going to be retiring after one or possibly two more flights. By the way, it should be retiring. I'm sure you haven't had an opportunity to get near one of these birds, but they are looking like roughly 30-year-old Boeing 727s. I mean, they're worn out. The wiring harnesses are cracking, the tiles are a mess. Basically, they've done their job, and that's it. What that leaves us with, though, in terms of getting up to, well, space station, for example, which is up there now, which is a very expensive machine in which we're supposed to be doing all kinds of research, the only ways we can get up there are with the Russians, who are very good at this, but they're limited as well.
What are they very good at, the Russians?
At launching people safely into space. They have a better track record than anybody else. And, of course, we have a couple of very inexperienced private companies that are, in some people's minds, the way in which it's going to go. These are Orbital Sciences and something called SpaceX, and they're going to be the saviors of the Western space program. Problem is, when you think about the Russians, they are good. They've had their last accident was many years ago, and they've been quite consistent since then. But they have limited capacity. They can only send three people up at a time. One might think that, well, you could just build a whole bunch more Soyuz rockets and capsules and things. But first of all, you don't step up production on something like that very easily. And secondly, the Russians really have very little reason to do so. Because if they spent all the time and effort and money that would be required to increase their capacity significantly, they would be left with all that excess capacity when the West says, oh, we've got our own machine now, so forget it, just go away. And so they have no real reason to increase their capacity. In terms of private companies, Orbital Sciences, which you know has a good, has been in the game quite a long time, the last two attempts they've tried to get satellites into orbit, they dropped them in the ocean. And SpaceX, which seems to be everybody's darling, probably because it comes from somebody who is involved in the web-related industry. SpaceX just doesn't seem to understand that simply putting an empty can into orbit and bringing it back does not make it a safe and reliable means of launching a human being. There's an awful lot more demand rating a system than what they've done so far. In fact, it's not easy to achieve a reliable system to get people into orbit, and there are those who would argue that we don't even have one now, given the rate at which we've been killing people. So there is a big, big problem for the next decade or more in terms of getting people into space at all. That'll pass. There, of course, was also supposed to be some work that was going to go on beyond low Earth orbit. We were going to go back to the moon, and then we were going to go to Mars, and Lord only knows where else. That was called the Constellation Program. It's been killed, and we aren't going to be going back to the moon or to Mars anytime soon. Once again, that's probably not such a bad thing. The reason it's not such a bad thing is because I think we're really not, not just I, but a lot of other people think we're really not ready to go. I mean, beyond the obvious problems, which are things like no money and technology that probably isn't good enough to take you to Mars, I mean, it might get you there if you're lucky, but I mean, when you think of the failure rate of space station, for example, it's not a big deal if a big pump fails on a space station. It certainly is if it fails on a vehicle on its way to Mars because you can't get the replacement parts. So, you know, there are monetary and technological issues that you have to deal with. They can be dealt with, and we more or less know how to do it. But beyond that, from a medical standpoint, I think we still have far too much to learn before committing ourselves to a manned Mars mission or any other space flight that requires a long period of time, such as a prolonged stay on the moon. Now, please, again, don't get me wrong. Like I said at the beginning, I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. We are going to go to back to the moon. We are going to go to Mars. We're going to go other places someday. We really must go someday. This is probably not the time, though. I guess, in summary, the bottom line is that we need to be confident that the crew members that we send out there are going to come back alive. It's as simple as that. And right now, we can't say that. So that's a major problem. And why is there a problem? Well, you can blame it all basically on evolution and the way in which we've evolved. You know, for millions of years, we as a species have evolved in a relatively fixed environment. Our world hasn't changed very much, some in terms of temperature and so on, but basically it's been a fixed environment. And we've become very superbly adapted to that environment, but also very narrowly adapted to it. Our bodies do what they have to do in this world. And now, on an evolutionary time scale, I really mean now, because it's only 50 years since we started going into space, all of a sudden we're inventing machines that are taking us into environments for which we're not well matched. We didn't devolve on them. And there are serious consequences in a lot of cases of doing that. Now, this is far from a new idea. It actually goes back at least to the days of Hippocrates, who wrote that sailing on the sea proves that motion disorders the body, which is a way of saying sailors get seasick. Now, you know, that may not seem particularly important. It may seem very obvious. And it is, obviously, it is to us today. But given when Hippocrates wrote that, this is not a trivial comment, because unlike his contemporaries, of which there were many, Hippocrates identified a specific environmental feature, namely motion, as the cause of seasickness. And he didn't just describe it to something like, you know, evil vapors or spirits or some other imaginary influence that was that happened to be in vogue in the day. He actually identified, he said the feature was motion. And in fact, we would just extend that a little bit today and say the motion that's outside of the normal physiological range. Now, what is the, when I say normal physiological range or normal operating range of the body, what does that really mean? Well, it basically means the range of environmental features in which we can operate without getting into some kind of trouble. It defines how far you can push things and still perform normally, or in some cases simply survive. And it applies to any kind of environment, or at least as a problem, it applies to any kind of environment that takes us beyond that range. Now, going back to Hippocrates and seasick sailors, it obviously applies to ships. And the environmental feature there are the waves. And waves can occur at a frequency that is lower than you would ever experience on land. That's all it is. It's just a lower frequency movement. But the inner ear, because of that, does not sense it correctly. It's outside of your normal range. You were never adapted. You didn't evolve to sense that kind of motion. You get incorrect signals, you end up getting seasickness. The concept applies, of course, to any kind of vehicle that flies in the atmosphere. And that goes back farther than you might think, because before we had fixed-wing aircraft, heavier than air aircraft, we also had balloons. And as far back as 1875, there was a launch of a balloon near Paris, in which three people went up in an open basket under a hydrogen-filled balloon. And they got up to about 5 miles, which is about 28,000 feet. And which, by the way, is lower than the summit of Mount Everest, the difference being that they had gone from essentially sea level to that altitude in a matter of hours. They had no adaptation whatsoever. And two of the three died. They died of hypoxia. They died because they couldn't, they didn't have enough oxygen. And interestingly enough, by the way, it was understood that you couldn't survive at that altitude without some kind of oxygen. And they died of a technological failure. They had some very crude oxygen generating equipment on board, and it failed. And two of the three of them died. So this is another example of going outside of the normal range. It's going into an area where the oxygen level is too low. Another example. The earliest airplanes were pretty flimsy affairs. You really didn't want to push them very hard because things would break. But it didn't take the engineers very long to design aircraft that could maneuver quite violently and could easily pull 4 or 5 G's, 4 or 5 times the force of gravity on a pull-up. You know, if you dive down and pull up like that, you introduce a centripetal acceleration, which can be easily, well, these days a lot more than 4 or 5 G's, but in those days 4 or 5 was plenty. The point was that as soon as the engineers managed to build airplanes that could do that, the pilots quickly discovered that they couldn't. And what was happening was that they would black out. When they tried to pull a 5G unprotected, that is, they didn't have any particular suits or anything they were wearing, an unprotected 5G pullout, they'd black out. They'd lose consciousness, and that's not a good thing to do in an airplane. So again, you were going beyond what the human body could tolerate, beyond the normal physiological range, and getting into trouble. Now, obviously, this goes back a long way. We know we have limits in ships, in airplanes, in balloons, and so on. And it applies equally well to spacecraft. It goes a little beyond the kinds of things that we experience in these other vehicles, but it certainly does apply in space to spacecraft. So for the next, 3 hours, two and a half hours, whatever, I'm going to ask, what are the problems that you face, that the body faces when you go into space? What are the solutions to these problems? What can you do about it? Can you do anything about it? And finally, I guess the ultimate question is, you know, what are the prospects, at least in the relatively near term or medium term, for moving terrestrial life, that's us, into space? This is kind of a three-lecture crash course in aerospace physiology, but I'm going to concentrate more on the consequences of these different environments than of the mechanisms. That would be taking on way too much, and so I'm just basically going to try to cover a number of different issues and what happens when you're exposed to these different environments. Now, some of the issues are shared with the aviation world. Those are typically understood and pretty well dealt with. But other things are unique to space and unique to space flight. And that's where the real problems are. Those are the ones that may be showstoppers, at least for the moment. Okay, let's get on to the first topic then. And that is acceleration. Now, if there's one thing that has to be obvious to anyone when it comes to the launch of a spacecraft, it has to be that vehicle ends up going very, very fast. Sometimes you kind of forget that speed is almost everything when it comes to a launch, not altitude. When you see a rocket launch, typically it launches vertically, and you say, well, it's going way up. Well, typically it's not going way up. It's going, obviously, a certain distance, but most of the time is actually spent building up speed, not altitude. And an analogy I like to use is a common styrofoam drinking cup, the kind you might have coffee in sometime. You know, there's a bit of a thick rim at the top, not too thick, but a bit of a rim. Now, if you consider the inside of that rim to be the surface of the Earth, or low Earth orbit is the outside of the rim. That's all it is. You're very, very close to the Earth. I mean, it's not too surprising. I mean, a low Earth orbit is like 120 miles or a little bit more than that. And the Earth, the diameter of the Earth is about 7,900 miles. So, you know, if you think about it proportionately, that's the way it is. You're spending most of your time building up speed parallel to the ground, actually. that, by the way, is just as an aside. It's why things like, Spaceship One, Spaceship Two, these things, these toys that are going to send passengers up into space are very easy to do and not particularly important. They're not building up speed horizontally. They're simply manned sounding rockets. They're going straight up, coming straight down, and that's a very easy thing to do. We've been doing it for a long, long time, and it's not even the same ballpark as getting into orbit, not even close. Anyway, if you're going to build up speed, it's going to take acceleration. You've got to go from a zero velocity relative to where we are here, for example, on the ground, to about 8 kilometers per second to get into low Earth orbit, which is, that's moving along. But you also have to do it in a relatively short period of time. And the end result is substantial acceleration. Now, it depends on the vehicle. The shuttle, which, of course, we have one or maybe two more launches of, is a rather benign environment. It peaks at about 3.4 Gs, which is something, I mean, you could stand up under 3.4 Gs and not have any particular problems. And it averages even less than that. More conventional rockets, things like the Soyuz launcher or the ones that they're talking about to replace the shuttle, they can pull up to 8 Gs going up. And then you start getting into an area where you really do have a lot of human factors problems and have to deal with them. The replacements for them, well, we don't really know what's going to replace the shuttle, but there have been at least a couple of suggestions of using the one solid rocket booster from the shuttle and putting something on top and then people on top of that. And the acceleration of that, if you really fiddle the SRB a lot so that you tailor the burn so it doesn't accelerate too fast at some point, It's going to be somewhere in between 3.5 and 8 Gs. It depends on how you do it, but it's actually fairly tolerable. But why is a linear acceleration a problem? Why does it matter if you are exposed to a constant linear acceleration? Well, first and foremost, let me just start up this thing before I forget here. Hey, about that, we got it. First and foremost, it's because it leads to pooling of blood in your body wherever down happens to be. And if, for example, if I'm standing here and I'm accelerating upwards, the floor for whatever reason starts going up, blood is going to pool in my legs, and simply because of the acceleration, the force that's going to push it downwards. That's going to reduce the amount. That by itself doesn't matter a whole lot. But the problem is that then reduces the amount of blood that's available to come back to the heart. The venous return goes down, and that then causes my blood pressure to drop. And obviously, there's a point where you aren't going to be able to get enough blood coming back to the heart to sustain any blood pressure, and that obviously would be a very bad situation. It's not all that simple, though. And if you look at the... this is a classic, somewhat old, actually, illustration of what happens when you're exposed to what's called a plus GZ acceleration. That's basically an upwards acceleration. It's as if I was standing here, or sitting, which is more likely the case, but upright. This is what happens as a function of time. Now, I'm going to have to try to do this with the with this pointer. Does that show up? Yes, it does. Good. Well, not very well. Anyway, there are several different circumstances here. One is a very quick acceleration, or at least a very quick onset of that acceleration, and it disappears very quickly. That's shown as example A. I'm just going to move that out of the way because it's not really very helpful. That would be equivalent to something like a catapult launch off an aircraft carrier, or a more violent thing such as an ejection from an aircraft that's in trouble. Each of those would be a very different level of acceleration, but what they would do, though, is they would come and go very quickly. I mean, this is what happens to us when we jump down off a box. If I jump down off this table onto the ground there, I could easily pull a transient 7 Gs, but it doesn't last long enough to matter. There's not enough time to move blood. There's not enough time to pool blood, so it really doesn't matter. So situation A there is just not a big deal. It's something that the body tolerates very nicely. However, B, where you go up and then across into this loss of consciousness zone, I guess it already says what happens. If you suddenly bring on a high G situation and maintain it, you will very, very suddenly lose consciousness. There's no prodromal warnings. There's nothing. You just go like that. And this is what happens. This is called GLOC, G-L-O-C, and it's G-induced loss of consciousness, and it's something that is a very real issue in modern fighter aircraft, for example, which can easily pull 12 Gs in a sudden pull-up or sudden turn, and the onset is very, very fast, a fraction of a second. You cannot tolerate that. You will lose consciousness. In this case, the aircraft runs way beyond what a person can tolerate. So, pull the Gs, a second later, 2 seconds later, 3 seconds, you're out. And hopefully the aircraft will take care of you until you regain consciousness. Those are kind of precipitous things. Perhaps a little more interesting are situations C and D, where the acceleration is gradually building up over time. And this is really more like being in a centrifuge or something, because normally you wouldn't experience that in flight. But let's say in situation C, you slowly increase the G level, the plus G Z acceleration. What happens there is initially not very much. You just feel like you're pulling Gs. But then you start getting what is termed visual symptoms on that illustration. Visual symptoms are a sign that you are on the edge of trouble. And they include things like gray out, for example, which gray out is simply losing color vision. All of a sudden, it's like you had a color television and you you lost the color. It's a black and white television all of a sudden. The world is gray. The reason for that being that the cones, the receptors of the eye that sense color, are much more sensitive to hypoxia than the rods. And so you lose them first. You lose their function as the perfusion of the retina goes down because your blood pressure is dropping. So all the world goes gray. Now the next stage is called tunnel vision, and that is where your gray world kind of shrinks in on you and you start being able to just see down a tunnel, down a relatively small part of your central vision. The reason for that is because the blood supply to the retina comes in more or less in the center at the back and then spreads out. And the farther you get from that source, the lower the blood pressure is going to be and the more susceptible it is to decreased flow. So you start losing your peripheral vision. And that's the peripheral rods that you're losing. So you have nothing left to see with. And so you lose all your peripheral vision. And all you can see is just down a tunnel down the middle. If you see that, you really should stop doing it because the next step is blackout. That is where you have lost all of your ability to see. The entire retina ceases functioning. And the next step very quickly is loss of consciousness, because if the retina is not getting blood supply, your brain is soon to follow. Not immediately, by the way, because the eye has a certain intraocular pressure. It has a certain pressure that the blood supply already has to fight against. And so it will go before the perfusion of the brain. Lose perfusion of the brain, you've lost consciousness, and you've lost control, and you're in trouble. Yeah? I'm sorry, how can he what?
A pilot equipment.
It depends on the aircraft. If it's a, what's called a fly-by-wire aircraft, one where you have essentially, you're working through a computer to fly it anyway, the computer can set limits on what you can do. Usually in a fighter aircraft, there are such systems in some fighter aircraft to avoid extreme G's, more the kind that break the airplane than break the pilot. Otherwise, if you're going to maintain the maneuverability and the combat effectiveness of the aircraft, you can't limit it. You have to let the pilot push himself to the edge. And there are ways also that the pilot can help himself. I'll get into that a little bit later. Finally, the D scenario there is one where the G's come on more slowly, and what you might notice there is that you can actually reach a higher level of G's before you start getting visual symptoms. And the reason for that is simply because over a matter of seconds, tens of seconds, things like the baroreceptor reflex kick in. This is the reflex that maintains your blood pressure, for example, when you jump up after you're lying down. You lie down, you jump up to your feet, and most people don't faint when they do that. That's because of the baroreceptor reflex, but it takes time to happen. And so with a few seconds, it'll kick in and you'll last longer. It's a relatively marginal help, but it is certainly better than nothing. Okay, so this is all G-induced loss of consciousness or other effects. But the nervous system is not the only part of the body that has trouble with increased G's. I mean, it's just one of the parts. This is a slide that illustrates how effectively you get air and blood into the lungs. Forget the graph at the bottom. That's really just a combination of the two upper ones. The two upper ones illustrate, first of all, that the top one is lung ventilation. And it's basically how well you get air into the lung at different parts of the lung, anywhere from the top of the lung on the left down to the bottom of the lung on the right. And the next one down is how well you perfuse the lung, how well you can get blood into the lung. Now, these two have to be matched up in some reasonable fashion, because getting air into the lung is necessary to get oxygen there, and of course if there's no blood to be oxygenated, that doesn't work either. So you have to have both ventilation and perfusion occurring reasonably well at the same time. What you see from here, if you look carefully, is on the top graph, At 1G, the ventilation is pretty good all throughout the lung. All the alveoli are opening and closing as appropriate, and airflow is more or less uniformly distributed throughout the lung. Even at 1G, though, blood flow is not uniform. You get much better blood flow lower in the lung than you do at the top. And that's simply because of the pressure head that's necessary to get to the top of the lung. Again, this is in the upright position. What you also see here, though, is that if you increase the Gs just a little bit, this is only to 3 Gs, on the top graph, you see a much steeper slope. And in fact, at some point, the top of the lung is not being ventilated at all. And the perfusion graph, the second one down, is even worse. Halfway down the lung, or halfway up the lung, really, you stop any perfusion because the heart cannot pump against the extra pressure that cannot produce the extra pressure that's required. So your perfusion and your ventilation decrease quite quickly. I think the perfusion thing is easy to understand. If you're operating under a greater G level, the heart has to work harder to get the blood higher up. The ventilation thing is a little bit more difficult, perhaps, and it's because the lung not only has to expand and contract, but it also has to support itself. And the bottom part of the lung tends to pull on the top part. And it's sort of like one of these old slinky springs or just any soft spring. If you hold it from the top and you let it dangle, the coils are farther apart at the top than they are at the bottom because of the mass of the spring that's pulling them down and expanding them out. Now, if they're already expanded out, they don't have very far to go. So that if you're operating under sufficient Gs, well, they don't expand at all because they're already fully expanded. So the top of the lung doesn't work very well. The result, of course, of all this is that you get much less efficient gas transfer when you're operating under Gs. And eventually, this is going to lead to a reduced saturation of blood with oxygen. You're going to be able to carry less oxygen. And that, at the same time as you're having blood pressure problems because of pooling in the periphery, means that you're really making the situation that much worse. The combination of poor gas transfer in the lungs and poor venous return makes it very difficult for the brain to keep operating. And I guess the bottom line of all this is because of the way nature has chosen to distribute oxygen around our bodies, it's a perfectly good, reasonable system when we're sitting in a lecture room like this or walking around outside. We're not very tolerant of any kind of increased linear acceleration. And it doesn't take very much, just a few Gs. And that's not a very strong acceleration. A few Gs is enough to totally disrupt the system. Trouble is, you need to get to orbit quickly. When you, at least today, if you're going to go very fast, if you're going to get into orbit, there is going to be a period of time at the beginning, and for that matter at the end when you have to slow down, in which you're going to be experiencing a very strong acceleration. These days with chemical rockets, they'll only burn for just so long. And 8 or 10 minutes is about the limit. And in that time, you've got to get up from 0 to 8 kilometers per second. That's an awful lot of acceleration. So what do you do about it? How can people survive this? Because it would be very easy to kill somebody with with the wrong rocket. One of the problems we have to deal with rockets is that with time, they start accelerating faster and faster. And the reason for that is simply because you're burning off fuel. So for the most part, rockets generate one level of thrust. I mean, some can be throttled a little bit. In fact, some can be throttled a lot. But they become much, much less efficient when you're off the optimal point. And you just can't afford that for a launch. So you're essentially talking about a system that has a constant thrust with a mass, a force, with a mass that's constantly going down at quite a rate. And so the acceleration goes up and can easily, very quickly, exceed the tolerance of the human body. So what do you do about it? Well, I'm not sure how well you can see that one. The left doesn't matter. That's just a John Glenn's launch. on an Atlas rocket. But this was one of the early, very straightforward ways of dealing with this issue. The Atlas, if you just left it untouched, would have very quickly gone beyond 8 g's acceleration, and that would not have been tolerated. So the way it worked was they had three engines on the bottom, and these burned up to, well, up to that first peak there. They reached a pretty substantial acceleration, not up to 8 g's, but below that. And at that point, having burned off that much fuel, where they really wanted to reduce thrust, they just threw away two engines. And it wasn't like you had boosters on the other side. These were engines that in fairings that just literally dropped off. And that's where you get that sudden dip down of acceleration, because now you've only got one engine left. But again, as the fuel more fuel burns off, it accelerates faster and faster. And by doing this, by simply dropping, literally physically dropping engines on the way up, it maintained the acceleration within the range where a human being can live. And literally, it is a matter of life and death. You could not tolerate much more than 8 g's on the way up. That's one way of doing it. Hello, wake up. Oh, interesting. Okay, I'm getting an update here, but you're... Oh, yeah, there we go. Okay. All right. Let me go back one step here. I think my machine was probably asleep. Okay, this is another way of doing... Oh, great, it's doing it all by itself. Well, I don't really need that. The shuttle is a little different. Of course, it's going away now, but it's a little different from the purely expendable rockets. It just takes longer to reach orbit. It extends the time of the burnout over time by quite a bit, and because of that, the acceleration doesn't have to be as high. Now, that's all very nice. You would say, well, let's just extend it over a very long period of time. And there are things like ion engines and potentially plasma engines that can burn for a very, very long time. The only problem is they don't produce enough thrust to launch with. They are potentially very useful for getting around in out of orbit and to other places in the solar system. But they're no good for launch. They just don't have the thrust. And so that's not, that's not a viable solution either. One of the ideas that people have come up with are these space elevators, basically a mass that's orbiting way above, far enough out that it's held in place and can actually generate some force because of centripetal acceleration. And then you put this long tether, and you put an elevator on it, and you go up to orbit, which is very nice theoretically. It's not quite practical yet. It may be someday, but I wouldn't hold my breath on that one. But that would be about the only way you can get to orbit with without having a very massive acceleration on the way up. Okay, so the first thing you do then is the first thing you're going to do to help keep the person alive is to minimize the acceleration. The second thing, and that I think was good. It's back awake. The second thing you do is position the person properly. Now I already said that in fact it matters how you apply, what the orientation of an acceleration is relative to the body. A lot of the things I'm showing you are acceleration in this direction, as if you were seated upright, and that's probably the worst position that you can be in. It's much better if the acceleration is applied perpendicular to your chest, if you're lying on your back, as on the left side here. And that is how Soyuz launch, people in Soyuz launch, how Apollo and all those capsules launched, and how some of the current designs would launch. It gives one much better tolerance, but there's still a limit. I mean, you can't, it's not a panacea. There is a limit. Interestingly enough, by the way, in the shuttle, people, when you launch, with the acceleration acting through your chest in this direction. When you're re-entering, where there's also substantial accelerations, You're actually seated upright. And it's only, again, because of a very prolonged period that this is tolerated. Not tolerated very well by people coming back from a space station. People who have been up for a couple of months have lost all of their ability to react to blood pressure changes. And they have to come back in the recumbent position. They have to be lying on their backs on special litters. Otherwise, they would certainly lose consciousness on the way back in. There's another way in which you can help the crew members. If the problem is pooling of blood in the legs, well, maybe you could just... grief, what's with this thing? Well, this is, I got to say, this is a new one for me. I've never seen a where the it lags behind like this. Okay, let me just try closing that and restarting it. Maybe that'll be happier. Oh, it did work. Okay. This is a little bit of the stuff on anti-G suits. And again, if blood is pooling in the legs, maybe you can just squeeze it back and all will be well. Well, all won't be well, but at least you can help a little bit. Anti-G suits are nothing more than a series of inflatable bladders that you wrap around your legs and abdomen, and you put some pressure in there. It's like a blood pressure cuff, very big blood pressure cuff. And when you squeeze it, you squeeze blood back up. And in fact, they do help. Just as an aside, the first anti-G suit was actually invented by somebody called Wilbur Franks in Toronto. And he did it using that device in the center there, which was the first human centrifuge in the British Commonwealth. In fact, it was the second in the world by about 2 months. It was right at the very beginning of these things. And that centrifuge was there because somebody called Frederick Banting, of Banting and Best insulin fame, decided just before the Second World War that he really needed to do something useful to help the Allies in what was the coming war. And he decided that understanding the phenomenon of pilots blacking out was a very useful thing to know. And so he managed to persuade people to build this human centrifuge, which was actually used well into the 1980s. I mean, I've actually ridden on that thing. And, you know, the physics doesn't change. It just it's just a centrifuge, and it was a very good one. The only problem with it was that it can't accelerate very quickly. It can get up to a high G level, but it can't get there quickly, which is something that we need today. Anyway, it was the first... the work done in there by Franks produced the Franks flying suit, which was the first anti-G suit in the world. Now, this may not sound like a... I mean, it gives you, by the way, something just under 1G of extra tolerance. That's all, just 1G. And this may not sound like very much, but, of course, in a combat situation, if you are you and another aircraft that doesn't like you are both pulling a tight turn... If you can pull a slightly tighter turn than the other guy, you end up on his tail with obvious consequences. Of course, if you're not as good as him, he ends up on your tail, and that's even worse. In terms of combat flying, a flying suit gives you that little bit of edge, and it made a very, very big difference in terms of the Battle of Britain and subsequent aerial warfare. But it also helps a little bit in terms of returning astronauts, because you don't want a pilot astronaut on the shuttle fainting when they're doing a reentry. They all wear not this suit, obviously a much more advanced version of it, but they all wear anti-G suits to at least minimize the chances of fainting. There's one other thing they do. This is really superstition. It's not doesn't work. But they drink a whole bunch of, in fact, a couple of liters of saline solution, of salt solution, before they re-enter, about 2 hours before they re-enter. The idea being that if you've got an awful lot of liquid in your vascular system, it doesn't matter if some of it pools because you've still got more to pump around. In reality, this has been tested. It doesn't work at all, but they do it. they hate doing it because it really it's a very unpleasant thing to drink 2 liters of saline. Okay, let me go on a bit here fairly quickly. If you're going to go anywhere in space, you have to go fast, and obviously physics dictates that there's going to be substantial static accelerations involved. There's also accelerations, though, in the higher frequency range. This is what we call vibration. And so vibration is just an acceleration with a frequency content. And this is especially true in shuttle. The shuttle shakes on launch. While the solids are ignited, the shuttle shakes terribly. But Soyuz does it too, by the way. Now, the shaking in shuttle or any time you have a solid rocket booster, such as some of the newer attempted designs, you've got supersonic flow, you've got shock waves inside the booster, you've got all kinds of sources in the machine itself to generate vibration. In the shuttle, actually, a lot of it also comes from just turbulent flow. The shuttle is not aerodynamic when it launches by any means, and as long as it's still in the atmosphere, you've got a tremendous amount of rumble from aerodynamic turbulence. When it lands, by the way, you would think that the shuttle, because everybody says it lands like a glider. Well, it does, because it doesn't have any power. But a glider or a sailplane is a very quiet machine. The shuttle roars when it comes over your head on short final, and it's purely because of turbulent flow. So there's a lot of vibration in there. Now, why is vibration a problem? Well, vibration's a problem because it can kill you. And hopefully we can... Oh, good, that's working now. Vibration is not something we tolerate very well. Now, this is an experiment where basically people were exposed to different levels of vibration with different frequency contents. So the levels of acceleration are on the y-axis, and the frequency of the content is on the x-axis. And put all together, what these investigators did years ago was to determine what the various boundaries are, so that at, say, 15 hertz, how far did you have to go in terms of acceleration, in terms of vibration, before a person could perceive it? How long before it became mildly annoying, and then extremely annoying, and eventually really scary? And put together this graph, and not surprisingly, as you go up in acceleration level, it becomes more and more obvious and more and more alarming. But the real issue is the big dip that you see roughly at 7 hertz all up along there. There's a consistent point there where the vibration is much less well tolerated than it is at a higher or lower frequency. And, what's that all about? That was a bit of a surprise. And again, this is from somebody seated upright. You get the same kinds of graphs if they're in a different orientation, but basically the same story. If you're seated upright and you're shaken up and down, what's happening at 7 hertz is that you're hitting the resonant frequency of the thoracic contents. That's the heart and the large blood vessels. That has, like any other mechanical system, that's, in this case, very poorly damped, it has a resonant frequency. Now, as you approach the resonant frequency, what happens? Well, as you approach the resonant frequency of any system, the amplitude of oscillation goes up, and the phase shifts by up to 180 degrees. So basically, you end up with a person that's going up when the heart's going down, and down when the heart's going up, and you're shaking the thoracic contents back and forth. That is a very dangerous situation. And in fact, this is something that... There was a situation when they were building the stretched version of the DC-8. Most of you don't remember what a DC-8 is. It's a big four-engine jet transport. And after the original airplane came out, they wanted more passengers, and they just added sections in front of and behind the wing, made it longer, but that also made it less stiff. And to make a long story short, when the test pilots were first flying this, they were coming back with chest pain and all kind of nausea and all kinds of symptoms that nobody understood until they recorded an electrocardiogram from some of these people while they were doing their test flying and noticed they were throwing arrhythmias and all kinds of cardiac signs that you really didn't like to see. And it was because, as it turned out, the resonant frequency of the fuselage had been reduced to the point where it hit the 7 hertz point, And they were being shaken very badly at a very, very dangerous point in time. So what do you do about that? Well, you stiffen the fuselage. It's not just in airplanes. These are, well, two different examples of, well, designs that might work. The one on the left is the Ares 1, which is not going to be continued. This is a, this was a NASA design that has now been canceled. The one on the right is called Liberty, and it's a, it also uses a solid rocket booster as the lower section, but then adds an Ariane 5 upper section. That's not going to be built for political reasons. In either case, if you tried to build it, you would run into serious problems with vertical oscillation of this system. You would have to be sure, and it's not easy to do, you'd have to be sure that that wasn't shaking up and down. Otherwise, you would certainly kill the crew members. Okay, I think that's all I have to say for today, and I'll continue on Monday. Thank you.